priest taken from among men to ordain for men in things pertaining to God, that he may offer both gifts and sacrifices for sin. Who can have compassion on the ignorant and on them that are out of the way, and that he himself is compassed with infirmity. And by reason hereof, he ought, as for the people, so also for himself, to offer for sin. No man taketh this honor unto himself, but he that is called of God, as was Aaron. So also Christ glorified not himself to be a high priest, but he said unto him, Thou art my son, today I have begotten thee. As he saith also in another place, Thou art a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. Who in the days of his flesh, when he had offered up prayers and supplications with strong crying and tears unto him that was able to save him from the dead, and was heard in that he feared. Though he were a son, yet he learned obedience by the things which he suffered. And being made perfect, he became the author of eternal salvation to all them that obey him, called of God a high priest after the order of Melchizedek.
All right, thank you, Ronnie. So verses 1 and 2, which we looked at last week, and we actually dipped back into verses 14 through 16 of chapter 4, such a wonderful text that indicates to us the compassion of Jesus as our high priest and everything that he does for us in that regard. He starts in chapter 5, kind of a bad chapter break here, but that's okay. We just kind of ignore those along the way and try to maintain the train of thought. Chapter 5, verses 1 through 4 really set forth the high priesthood, if you will, under the Levitical system. And he sets forth there some various things by which a man was made high priest, or by which one became high priest. And then in verses 6 through 10, what he's going to do is he's going to see how Jesus, correspondingly to that same example, qualifies as our high priest. So just pick up with the thought of verse 3 as he's talking about the humanity. And much of the verses 1 and 2 was focused on the humanity and the compassion of the high priest. That is, he was taken from among the people because he was one of the people. And he needed to be able to understand the plight of the people. Remember, the work of the priest in general and the high priest as well would be to make atonement for the people's sins. Okay, and as these people would be coming to him, confessing their sins, bringing their sacrifices, he wouldn't be tempted to look down on them because he himself is plagued with the same weaknesses and the same struggles that they are. And thus, likewise, he should be compassionate toward those who are weak and to those who fall into sin. Now, verse 3 says, because of this, he is obligated to offer sacrifices for his own sins, just as he does for those of the people. Okay, now it's kind of shifting to the unique work of the priesthood from that of the general priest and the ordinary work of the priest to the high priest himself in reference to the Day of Atonement. That was a specific day in which the high priest would enter into the Holy of Holies and he'd offer a special sacrifice for the sins of the people, and he'd do that one time a year. It was the only time anyone was allowed to enter, if you will, into the very presence of God with the Ark of the Covenant and the mercy seat, and he'd have the special sacrifice that he would offer for all of the sins of the people. Now, before he did that, verse 3 says he's obligated to offer a sacrifice for his own sins. Okay, before he can go and minister for the people, he has to first atone for himself, because he's going into the presence of God, and he himself is plagued by sin. And so to qualify himself, if you will, to be able to even go in and offer the sacrifice the people need, he has to first offer himself a sacrifice for him, for his family. There's also other kind of interesting to see ceremonial washings and things that had to be done before he ever goes in to the most holy place. Only then, after he prepares himself, can he go in on behalf of the people. And kind of a quick lesson for us today. If you think about it, we are priests. Peter makes that clear that we are a kingdom of priests today. And so there's a sense in which we have this unique relationship with God because of Jesus Christ and what he has done for us, but we also minister to one another, in a sense, as priests do. And I was visiting with a lady yesterday, a friend of a friend, and we were just talking about how when you get involved in just your service to God as a Christian, so much of that is focused on helping others, serving others, attending to their needs. And we talked about how there is this need to fill yourself up, because you can't pour from an empty cup. And anybody that's ever found themselves just exhausted by ministry, and by ministry I use the term very, very generally, in serving others, in doing good, that is, I'm not talking about the work of a preacher, but rather the work that we all have to see to the needs of others and help one another. If you just persist in that and persist in that, then you can just find yourself dried up. And that's why you kind of got to take care of yourself so that in doing so, you take care of others. You know, and the point is, you can't help others unless you first help yourself. You can't help someone else walk close to the Lord unless you're walking closely to the Lord. You can't admonish someone to be frequent in God's word and in prayer if you're not. Okay, so it starts with us first. We must first minister to ourselves, just as the priest would offer the sacrifice for himself, then go help the people. So we must do ourselves. We must first see to ourselves and ensure our own walk with God, and then we're qualified to be able to help others. Now, the big implication of this being, this Levitical priest had to first offer a sacrifice before he could ever go and offer a sacrifice for the people. Jesus didn't have to do that. You know, as we're going to see and look at Jesus' superior priesthood, Jesus didn't have to do that. You know, the Levitical priest offered for himself, and then he'd go in. Jesus didn't offer for himself because there was no sin to that he needed to cleanse to be qualified to enter into the presence of God and minister for the people. And that's kind of just lurking there in the background and will probably be more fully expressed later on in our study. So verse 4 says, "No one takes this honor for himself, but only when he was called by God, just as Aaron was." So verses 1 through 4 really set forth the qualifications of the high priest under the old law. And verses 5 through 10 are going to talk and demonstrate how Jesus met all of these same qualifications, and thus he is also qualified as a priest. So as to the high priesthood, no one takes this honor for himself, but only when he was called by God, just as Aaron was. Now, ironically, at this time, and also during the days of Jesus as well, the high priesthood has become corrupted. It has become more of a political office. It was, in fact, you can kind of trace the history of the priesthood after Christianity really takes over, and we don't find out much about what's going on with the Jews. You know, after Jesus steps onto the scene, it's really the focus has shifted to him, but you can find out how the priesthood is corrupted, and it wasn't through being called by God to serve as high priest. Rather, bribes and political persuasion and various things like that went into who, you know, stepped into this next role as the high priest. But as it was ordained by God, and as the position was ordained by God, this wasn't something that you could say, well, I think I want to be high priest. You know, I want to grow up and be high priest one day. You can't just step into that position. For that matter, you couldn't just step into the position of priesthood, could you? There were specific qualifications. There's a special calling that one had under the old law to serve as a priest or high priest on behalf of the people, just as he pointed out, as Aaron was called. So here's a little Old Testament trivia. Can you think of anyone? There's several examples. Can you think of anyone who stepped out of their improper domain, that is, they were unqualified to serve as priest, and they tried to step into that position to disastrous consequence? Can you think of any times when that happened? Scripture?
I can think of, but I can't.
Think of it, but you can't recall it. Can you recall any occasions where that happened in Scripture?
Sons of Eli.
Yeah.
Okay. Right, sons of Eli, but in what sense, Ronnie?
Well, they offered up incorrect. I mean, they were doing it not because of compassion for the people. They were doing it for their own good.
Yeah. Yeah, their motives were certainly greedy, and they kind of violated, if you will, the order that God set forth. There was a specific part that the priest was to get, and the sons of Eli, they said, give me the best cuts, essentially. And, you know, for God, just give me the best. They wanted the best. Yeah, they certainly violated the order. Dad?
Saul stepped in and offered sacrifice.
Yeah, I think of Saul. Who was he waiting on?
Samuel.
He's waiting on Samuel. There's this big battle coming. Samuel hasn't arrived. He's late. Saul knows it's almost time to fight, and so he steps in to the place of a priest and offers the sacrifice. Samuel gets there and rebukes him. It's a big deal when he does that. In fact, that's one of the things that leads to Saul's ultimate downfall as king. Good. Anybody else? Johnny, did I see your hand earlier?
One of the kings, was it
Uzziah? Yeah. Yep. Where did he go? He actually went into the temple.
He went all the way in off the sacrifice and struck with leprosy.
Yeah. As I said, you don't step into this position of priesthood without this great consequence. So Saul was rejected as king, as Dad pointed out, when he offered the sacrifice in place of Samuel. King Uzziah, who, oddly enough, was one of the great kings of Judah. He goes into the temple, and this is later in his reign. He goes into the temple, and he tries to step into the place of priest. And as Johnny pointed out, the Lord strikes him with leprosy, and then all of the priests just get him out of there real quick, and that's really the end of him. Tommy?
Yeah.
Okay.
And they
Yeah.
And 250 people and their families all swallowed up.
Yeah. That's real good there. Y'all've got three, and I only put down four. Korah, Dathan, and Abiram, I think. It's the rebellion of Korah. I think one of them was from the tribe, I feel like, of Levi. And essentially his argument is, why did the Levites, specifically, why did the sons of Aaron get to offer sacrifices? Are not all of God's children chosen? Are not all of God's children holy? Okay? And so he challenges, essentially, the authority of Moses and Aaron and the high priesthood. And as a result of that, like you said, the Lord really strikes him down, and him and his family and all, his animals and all of his loved ones. So he's another one. After that, kind of an interesting event, God calls, just to prevent this from happening, he calls all of the heads of the families together, and he takes a stick from each of the 12 tribes, and he says, whichever one grows, you know, whichever one grows is going to be the one chosen by God. And you remember, who's it was Aaron's staff that budded, right? We talk about Aaron's staff being in the Ark of the Covenant, one of the three sacred things that was kept there, but that was, it grew because it was God's validation that Aaron was the one chosen for the high priesthood, him and his family. And that's really where the budded staff of Aaron came from. But yeah, that's tied into the Korah, Dathan, and Abiram rebellion. Good. Xavier?
Jeroboam.
Yeah. All right. Well, we got four out of four. I put four down and y'all got all four. So what about him?
He anointed priests at Dan and Bethel.
Yeah. Okay. Yep. Not just from Levi. He would anoint them from any tribe. You know, he was trying to gain popularity. He was trying to keep the people close to home. And so he says, hey, anybody can be a priest. So the specific qualifications, being called by God, being from the tribe of Levi, he just kind of threw out the window and allowed anybody to offer.
I was thinking a different thing. I was thinking later on when, like, Herod would appoint high priest.
Yeah.
Anybody could be a high priest. That's what I had.
Yeah, that really fits the context of the day and age of Jesus, right, a little better. You had men who were unqualified, but through their political power and through their friends that they make and through money, would be able to step into this position as high priest. All right, real good there. We got all of those that I thought of, and there may be others. I don't by any means claim omniscience in that regard. But the point being, there were unique qualifications, and one, as is illustrated here, has to be called by God. That is, he has this calling by the Lord to serve in this way. And when you stepped into that position, not called by God because you simply wanted it for yourself, there were disastrous consequences that followed. So the call to priesthood was a call that came from God, and no one could take that upon themselves. And here he transitions now, talking about just the general qualifications of the priest to Jesus and how Jesus then meets those qualifications. So also, Christ did not exalt himself to be made a high priest, but was appointed by him who said to him, you are my son, today I have begotten you. And as he also says in another place, you are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. So the argument's ultimately going to build to this point where he shows that Jesus is infinitely superior to the priest under the old covenant, and he's going to show now how Jesus is qualified. Well, why is Jesus, did he not take this upon himself? Did he not do like Korah and Dathan and Jeroboam and Uzziah and Saul and step into something that wasn't designed for him? And so here the Hebrew writer wants them to understand, no, Jesus wasn't like them. He didn't exalt himself to be high priest. He didn't take it upon himself. Rather, he was appointed by God. And he goes on to say, you know, just as Levitical high priest didn't take the mantle upon themselves, Jesus didn't take it upon himself. Rather, he is the Son of God. God appoints him to this unique priesthood where he says, you're a priest after the order of Melchizedek. So let's think about this just a little bit, Johnny. I know you've got a lot of thoughts on this. We've talked about this just in personal conversation before. Let's try to kind of keep it vague. Chapter 7 is really going to deal with the high priestly order after that of Melchizedek. And without running too far ahead, you know, let's just kind of familiarize ourselves with Melchizedek, who he was, and then what it means to be a priest after his order. And then we'll get more fully to that and expand on that thought in chapter 7. So who was Melchizedek? Anybody call him to mind? Okay, he was a king and a priest.
King of Salem.
Okay. Who did he have a run-in with where he really emerges into Scripture? Abraham. Okay, it was after Abraham had defeated the armies that had taken, you know, the four armies that had taken captive Lot and Sodom and Gomorrah and so forth and so on. And as he's coming back, he meets this Melchizedek, this priest of Salem, this king and priest of Salem. Okay, so kind of a unique character, pops onto the scene very strangely for just a moment, and you don't see him anymore. You have reference to him in the Psalms, where, and this is a quotation, where it says, you know, you are a priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek, kind of emerges onto the Psalms, but God's got a plan And God's got a foreshadowing, if you will. This Melchizedek is pointing toward something more significant, and that is the priesthood of Jesus. And really, that's the reason he comes onto the scene. And once again, I'm just amazed by the intricacy and the omniscience of God as he gives us his word. You've got this Melchizedek character, and under the old law, they had no idea what that meant. They couldn't have any idea what that meant. It isn't until you get to the new law and God's revelation is more fully given to us that you understand, okay, I now understand why Melchizedek comes onto the scene. He's foreshadowing someone. He's foreshadowing not just someone, he's foreshadowing a new priestly order. Okay, and that's going to be the argument of much of chapter 7, that if there's this new order of priests, that necessitates this new covenant. Okay, so then you've got the Melchizedek who appears, this guy Melchizedek who appears in Genesis. He's a priest, he's a king, he's king of Salem. That's really all we need to know. We'll get more into him and maybe that event in Genesis when we get to chapter 7. And then for Jesus to be a priest after his order, he's not a priest according to the Levitical order or the order of Aaron. He's going to be a priest according to the order of Melchizedek. So we'll just kind of leave it there. Anybody else want to weigh in on this? Otherwise, we'll just reserve our comments for chapter 7. John?
Not so much on Melchizedek. Say, the office of the priesthood is one of the main reasons, if not the main reason, that the children of Israel and the Jews in general had so many problems. It was not only because of the priests not doing their job, but it was like we just talked about these other individuals, maybe kings that came in and tried to take the office upon themselves. But all of those situations that you look at led to different problems and why that Christ was so much better as a high priest than what anything else had seen before.
Right. Yeah, Jesus is qualified in the same way and even beyond that. And all of those men, like you say, it's usually a deficiency. They call someone to try to step up, right? Jesus had none of those deficiencies. He is the perfect high priest. Good observation, John. Dad?
The office of high priest and priest in general was one of the most difficult responsibilities of the people of God's people. It obviously was going to put the law in the people vying for it. But the way God had set up, it was a difficult daylight dark. Hard work, blood, sweat, everything else all day long. And both, you see Caiaphas offering sacrifices all day long, standing up there on the, it was a good part.
Yeah.
But then Christ comes along, and you see the same thing, you see the work, the burden that goes with it, blood, and sacrifice. So people feel
what did Jesus do after he offered the sacrifice? Sat down, right? Like you said, it's hard work being priest. I don't know why anybody wanted it. It'd be a nasty job. I guess probably because of the authority that would come with it. The prestige, maybe the honor that would be given to the men, kind of in this position of spiritual leadership. And the priest also had unique duties to understand the law, to be instructed in the law, and this would fall to the Levites as well, but to be teachers of the law. And so I guess I can understand from one perspective why someone would be drawn to that or want to step in that even if they weren't qualified. But as you pointed out, it was a nonstop on your feet, hard work kind of job. And Jesus, after he offered his sacrifice, sat down. And that indicates the completion, and we've pointed that out before. All right. Tommy, did I see your hand?
Yeah. Stop me if I start stepping on what you were talking about in the next chapter. One of the things I draw from the parable is that the Bible tells us that Moses, Abraham, Abraham's known as the father of Israel. So
yeah. Yeah. Yep. So that's one of the things that's going to demonstrate Jesus' superiority as priest, right? Is he comes from this Melchizedekian order. I suppose that's a word. I think I've adjeticized that. Melchizedekian order, or the order of Melchizedek, if you want to use the most biblical term. that shows, because like you said, Abraham, and Seven is going to point this out, we can say it now, and I'm sure we'll probably be in chapter 5 and 6 long enough that by the time we get there, it'll be fresh. It'll be fresh for us all over again. But because of the order of Melchizedek, and Abraham is inferior to Melchizedek, thus the Levitical order is inferior, and the national, if you will, order is not really what God had fully visualized. Okay, there's a sense in which, yes, they were God's people, but as you pointed out, God's people were on the basis of faith. That's how the descendants of Abraham emerged, through faith in Jesus. And Melchizedek was greater than Abraham because, like you pointed out, Abraham then kind of tithes toward him, showing his inferiority, the lesser gives to the greater. Yep.
So that also shows the implication
of them. They were sinners themselves, and that's one of the reasons he's going to bring out Jesus is superior. He didn't have to do what they had to do by offering first the sacrifice for himself. Good. All right, great comments there. Verse 7, in the days of his flesh. Now, we've kind of moved from showing Jesus being called as the priests were called. Jesus is called according to a different order, but he's called by God nonetheless. Now we're going to see his compassion. And this was one of the things that was illustrated in verses 1 and 2. That is, the priest was to be a man of compassion. He was taken from among the people. He could sympathize. Okay, we're seeing the compassion now that Jesus possessed that qualifies him to be a high priest. In the days of his flesh, Jesus offered up tears, prayers, and supplication with loud cries and tears to him who was able to save him from death, and he was heard because of his reverence. So what's this a reference to? What in time? What's it describing? What event? What event is being described here or referenced in verse 7 in Jesus' life? Yeah, okay. That has to be what he has in mind. We know that Jesus was compassionate through his many dealings and sufferings in this life, but you see here kind of a pointing towards something specific. I think, like you say, Tommy, that is his prayer in Gethsemane, which we read about near the end of the Gospels. David? What's that?
The time of his humiliation before the
death. Yeah, which one specifically? Are you like do you have you mean just his suffering leading up to death?
Yeah,
I would say so. I would say so. But kind of, like he suffered the last 16 hours of Jesus' life were just an immense period of suffering. And I think you could probably point to that period as a whole. I kind of see the prayers and supplications with loud cries and tears. You see all of those described and narrated in Matthew's gospel. You could go to probably Matthew chapter 26, I think it is. And it kind of talks about the humiliation that he suffers in Gethsemane. The humiliation of the cross would be incorporated in that as well,
yeah.
Right?
Steve said it better. You know, normal high priests had that. You know, they weren't imperfect.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't. He humbled himself.
Yeah.
And he, for no reason other than love and because God.
Right. Right. Yeah, I think of Philippians 2, that said, although he was in the form of God, it says he emptied himself and took on the form of a bondservant. So yeah, his humiliation in general, just in leaving heaven and becoming a man and making himself susceptible to all the things that humanity is, right? That really highlights his compassion. Good. And I think verse 7 here is pointing us to the Garden of Gethsemane, where it says he offered up prayers and supplication with loud cries, and his humanity in general. But there in the garden, we know that Jesus had perhaps Jesus' most human moment, we might say. We have to understand, Jesus was human in every sense that we are, yet without sin. But where I think you most clearly see his humanity is there in the garden. You see him most vulnerable. You see him at his, just to use the frailness of the flesh, you see him at his weakest there. Okay, as he's essentially on his face, weeping and crying, praying to God, begging, let this cup pass. Okay, everything that the future held for him, he's praying, let this cup pass. I think you see him there in his humanity. Now, the point of all of this being is to show, because Jesus experienced everything that it means to be human, he's qualified to be compassionate. Just as a high priest taken from men, knows what it's like to be tempted, and knows what it's like to sin himself, is qualified to then be compassionate to other sinners. Jesus, although he never sinned, knew what it was like to be tempted. And Jesus, although he never sinned, knew what it was like to cry out to God. And there seems to be, you have to say, there's some sort of, although yes, Jesus and the Father were one, okay, even in Jesus' incarnation, even in his humanity, something was different, okay, because Jesus was a man in the same way that we were. And what do we find him doing so oftentimes is praying. Yes, he was one with God, and yes, he knew the will of God, and yes, he was God, but yet Jesus goes and he prays to the Father, and you see him there crying out to the Father to save him from the cup, all that was coming, if there was any other way. And he just places himself in complete dependence upon God. And I think that's the Hebrew writer's point here, maybe diving too much into the specifics. He yields himself completely to the dependence upon God, and as he cries out in this great moment of vulnerability for God to save him, and save him from death, not just save him, but save him from death. And he was heard because of his reverence. So let's think about this question for a moment.
Well, before we go on, we'll ask this one other thing. That
yes, sir, John.
To me, stands out.
Okay.
The first, as you said, is pointing toward the humanity of Christ. But very similar incidents, in part, not in complete incidents, but at the death of Lazarus.
Yeah.
Again, the compassion that he had. He that was really the same thing as any other human be with the loss of a close friend.
Yeah. Tears perhaps express in a unique way, I mean, that's what it is to be human, right? I mean, humans, I don't know, maybe you've thought about that, maybe not. But, you know, that's kind of unique to humanity is our ability to cry in response to like emotional distress, like you pointed out in John chapter 11, where Jesus is at the grave of Lazarus and he sees Mary and Martha weeping and he sees people weeping and he knows Lazarus is dead and he says, Jesus wept. You know, we oftentimes think of that, well, that's the shortest verse in the Bible. That's what that verse is known for in our minds. But that verse really indicates the depth of Jesus' humanity, the fullness of Jesus' humanity. He was not like us human, but different. He was human in the way that we are, you know, in that there were times in his life, and if you've ever hit rock bottom so that you're on your face and you're weeping and you're crying, you're asking for God's intervention, you're at your lowest moment, completely dependent upon God, Jesus has been there. Okay? And when we weep and cry over the death of loved ones, Jesus has been there. And that's the Hebrew writer's point here. In the days of his flesh, Jesus knows the flesh. Jesus knows humanity in every way that we do. And that qualifies him uniquely to be able to look at our weakness and our frailties and intercede then to God. Okay? And I think that's really one of the things being brought forth here. Did I see another hand? Does somebody want to comment? Tommy? Yeah, strengthen him for the trials that were in.
Yeah.
Why do you think the angel appeared to strengthen him? Who was supposed to be strengthening him? Who was supposed to be with him and helping him?
Awesome.
Yeah, Peter, James, and John, remember? Come pray with me. But they're snoozing. You know? So the Lord sends an angel and provides strength for him in that moment. So good observation, Tommy. In fact, we're going to kind of touch in that direction as we're going to shift just a moment to the idea of prayer.
Passionate side of Jesus that here is showing again his nature as a human being. It also, from the standpoint of the priesthood, was concerned that the being again the better of the high priest because of this compassion, which in this time the high priest himself was anything but compassionate.
Yeah. It's interesting to see, you really see the antithesis of that with people like Caiaphas and their abuse and their mistreatment. Like we pointed out, it had become a political office and it became a way in which a man might exploit others and use his power and get rich off of the people. And there was a complete lack of compassion, interestingly. Is it then any wonder that now, at this point, that the priesthood has become corrupted, that this is a time that Jesus steps onto the scene and our true high priest emerges? David?
No, this, him giving himself up, what strikes me is that, you know, if we were all standing outside and there was a kid run out or the car comes, there's not anybody here that wouldn't in that instant go push that kid out of the way and, you know, maybe give himself up to save that kid in a moment's time. But if they had to stop and think about that, you know, how would the mind work? Jesus had all this time to think about this. He knew what was coming.
Mm-hmm.
And the tears didn't sweat. That's the most human form. That's the most human form there is. I mean, tears and sweat, whatever.
Yeah.
It just speaks volumes.
Yeah, well, you see kind of sweat coming into the picture. Think of the curse, right? That's the result of the curse and the fall of man. Jesus takes on, you know, the worst of humanity, everything that it meant to be human. And the point of all of this is, and well, maybe not the point of all of this, is he's kind of setting Jesus up to show how Jesus is qualified. But something that we certainly take away here is, once again, reiterating the words of verses 14 through 16 of chapter 4, we don't have a high priest who's unable to sympathize with our weakness. We sometimes, it's easy, and I admit, it's easy. It's easy to think that God is just so far removed from us and our problems and our hurting and our suffering and our weakness and our sin. And the point of this is to say he's not. He's not in the person of Jesus Christ, because Jesus Christ came and knows what it is to be human and to suffer and, like you pointed out, David, to sweat and to cry and to have to depend on God in prayer and to lean on the Lord to make him through. In the worst moments of his life, he's there leaning on God. And because of he embraced everything that it meant to be human, he can be sympathetic toward us. And he can forgive us time and time and time and time and time again, because he knows. He knows. He can sympathize. And his mercy and grace is unlimited. And it's just waiting for us to come and to ask for it so that he might freely dispense it to us. All right. I had a question at this point. Yeah. So maybe you kind of wondered at this point where it says he cries out in the garden for God to save him from death. And it says he was heard because of his reverence. Not heard in the sense like God heard the prayer. Okay, I hear what you're asking. But heard in the sense that God hears and responded to that. That he hears Jesus' cry to save him from death, and he saves him from death. So maybe you kind of stumbled in that, and that kind of led me to ask this question, at least to get you thinking. So how was Jesus saved from death even though he died?
Spiritual death. He ascended to heaven to be with God.
Okay. Personally, I didn't think about it in the term of spiritual death, but okay, safe from spiritual death. But I mean, yeah, I could see that. Tommy?
Yeah, I think he's referring here to physical death. You know, all of us are spiritual. We live all after we die.
Right.
He was brought back to life and lived among what was it, 40 days?
Yeah, as a man.
And, you know, mm-hmm. ate, drank, talked.
Okay. Yeah, that's kind of how I took it, where you would go to Acts chapter 2 and verse 27, speaking of Jesus, and this is a prophecy made by David, but it says, speaking of Jesus, for you will not abandon my soul to Hades, or you will not let your Holy One see corruption. So I think you're talking, that's kind of the way my mind was tracking, toward the resurrection. Jesus was heard in that he was saved from death, in that he did not remain dead, but he was heard by God, and God answered that prayer, so that, although yes, he died, he didn't remain in Hades. He was saved from death. And you know what? We will be too. In that same way, we will be too. That although, yes, we may, like Jesus, you know, our bodies may be dead for a time, but we will live again because of him. Say a comment, Dad.
We use the expression, he died, rose again, died no more. So in one sense, his body didn't suffer the physical decay because he rose from the dead.
Right.
Okay, yeah. While it was changed, so he didn't suffer the, we might say, the terminal death that humans ordinarily suffer.
Okay, well, I see where you're going. I don't know that I'd get that technical with it, but ultimately I think you're pointing kind of where we are, that Jesus, although he died, he rose, and so he didn't remain in that state. That we will for a longer period of time than Jesus, unless the Lord just, you know, returns within moments of our death, literally. But you know, he didn't remain in the grave. I think that's the emphasis of how Jesus' prayer was heard. So let's kind of conclude with this thought. As you read verse 7, do you find anything there? Do you find any lessons that will help us as we think about prayer? And you see Jesus at a very vulnerable moment praying. Any lessons there that we can learn? David?
Just like we're talking about the finality of death, he did not have the finality of death. With him. Prayer can keep us from the finality of sin. We can be in sin and we ask for forgiveness and prayers, you know, we can escape that finality of this.
Yep. And Jesus' words to his apostles in the garden, watch and pray so that you don't enter into temptation, because prayer was what was going to deliver them. And as you say, prayer is the means by which we speak to God, and Jesus intercedes on our behalf, and through prayer we can avoid the finality of the consequence of our sin. Good. I see somebody over here. Tommy? Yes. Yes. The angel came strengthening Jesus, right? I mean, that was what was needed in this vulnerable moment, and the angel came and strengthened him. Good. Johnny? He what?
Defeated.
Yeah, that's one that you see in Hebrews and in Revelation. He didn't just not die and avoid it. He defeated it. I mean, he put an end to it. Oh, death, where's your sting? Oh, grave, where's your victory? He took his strength away, you know, in dying. But he had to die in the process to do that. And kind of as Dick pointed out earlier, talking about spiritual death, Jesus went to be with the Lord, and I think that's what spiritual death is. It's not being with the Lord. And so in that sense, you know, you could say that Jesus avoided spiritual death because he went back to be with the Father. All right, thank you so much for your participation, your comments in our class, your thoughts, and all of that. We'll pick up next week in verse 8. And y'all, just a real good discussion this morning. So verse 8 of chapter 5 next week. We'll resume. Hey, buddy. Huh? Daddy's teaching Bible class up here.
Who did you study about this morning?
Do you know how to mute the? Yeah, do you know how to mute the live stream back there? Would you get that going if you would?
Yeah.